expected. So that's that. Any other questions about the program? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we can now proceed. We are really 5 minutes into our time. I've got Mr. Hoffman from the, it is with the Class Foundation, but I think you call yourself a constitutional.
Thank you.
So that's basically the submission that we've got that is what's the index on that one?
JLC9.
We have your work information. Please proceed, Mr. Warren. You have 10 minutes to review your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members who have braved the somewhat patchy traffic in Cape Town this morning. At least the cars were moving for a change. I'm told by the secretary of the committee that all members do have a copy of the written comment which has been submitted by the Centre for Constitutional Rights. As this is the first time that the Centre for Constitutional Rights has appeared before the committee, I want to introduce myself and my centre to the members of the committee so that at least they know who we are and where we're coming from. The Centre for Constitutional Rights is a unit of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. It's only been going for about a year, and its mission is to uphold the Constitution. Mr. de Klerk was a president of this country at one stage, has identified the need to uphold the values of the Constitution as a way of securing his legacy. This unit, in which my assistant director who prepared the written submissions and I work, is the manner in which the de Klerk Foundation seeks to uphold the Constitution. So in much of what I say today, I will be looking at the legislation from a constitutional perspective. The mission involves informing the public of their constitutional rights, lobbying as we are doing now, and assisting people to assert their rights. And certainly when we are talking about the type of legislation which is now before this committee, there are many aspects of the Constitution which are relevant to the members' deliberation of the provision of the draft bill before you. We pointed out in our written submission, which I'm not going to read in 10 minutes because I can't speak that far.
And you can take it as read.
I'm taking it as read, and you will see that we pointed out in our written submission that our view, there is a need for the type of reform that this bill contemplates, but that we see and that it's laudable that the government is taking steps to make the reform. We see sore thumbs sticking out of this laudable attempt to address the problem. So what I'm going to do in the first instance is remind members of provisions in the Constitution that they need to bring somewhere near the front of the stone when they are deliberating section by section on the provisions of this bill. And the first six numbers that I'm going to give you are all numbers that are eligible for use in the lotto. And if they come up in the lotto, and next time we have the lotto, I will only expect 10% of whatever you win. Numbers are, and they are numbers of the Constitution section, 1, 7, 22, 34, 35, and 36. I want to dwell on those six briefly at the outset. Section 1 is, of course, the foundational principle, and the part of Section 1 that we need to bear in mind when we deliberate today is 1C, which identifies the foundational value as the supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. We need to bear that in mind as the basis upon which our discussion takes place. Everybody knows 7.2, the mantra of all human rights lawyers: respect, protect, promote and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights. 22, you're going to hear more about when the judges have their turn later this morning, says every citizen, I think it should have been all citizens, would have read better, have the right to choose their trade, occupation or profession freely. The practice of a trade, occupation or profession may be regulated by law. And that has to be read together with Section 36, which is the well-known limitation for the section, which I don't need to remind you of. At the back or behind what we are trying to do in the reforms contemplated here is Section 34 of the Constitution. That section says that everyone has the right to have any dispute that can be resolved by the application of the law decided in a fair public hearing before a court, where appropriate, another independent and impartial tribunal or forum. That is what the goal is of tweaking the judicial system in order to make it deliver what the people of South Africa need, which is access to justice and access rapidly. 35, the last of my first six sections, is the section that deals with the right to a fair trial. And I draw attention particularly to 35.3d. Every accused person has the right to a fair trial, which includes the right to have their trial begin and conclude without unreasonable delay. Now, we all know that our prisons are bursting with prisoners, many of whom are awaiting trial prisoners because there are delays in the system at the moment. That is something that obviously does need to be addressed and needs to be borne in mind when we are looking at how judges and retired judges should be spending their time. Then, I want to refer also to remind members, because I'm sure they're very aware of these provisions, of the provisions of Section 165.2 of the, I do apologize for that, and I will kill it. The provisions of 165.2 are of cardinal importance in these deliberations. It says the courts are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the laws, which they must apply impartially and without fear, favour, or prejudice. 3. No person or organ of state may interfere with the functioning of the court. And 4, which is what we are doing now, organs of state, through legislative and other measures, must assist and protect the courts to ensure the independence, impartiality, dignity, accessibility, and effectiveness of the courts. That's very central to what we have under discussion, and indeed what we are doing today is constitutionally permitted, if one has a look at Section 180B of the Constitution, because that says that national legislation may provide for matters concerning procedures for dealing with complaints about judicial officers and other matters. The other two sections of the Constitution that need to be borne in mind as we think about how to tackle the legislation under consideration are Section 195.1b and Section 237.
Now, I said that there are two thoughts I'm picking up in this legislation. The first is that the way in which outside work by sitting judges is approached is going to get us into trouble that will make the Oasis Shorty Crisis look like a Sunday school picnic. People wait in jail for it turn to appear before a judge. Civil litigants wait when they've got their pleadings closed for a year or more in the big division before they get their day in court. That's not right. What you need is judges who are fully, permanently, full-time committed to getting the work of the court done. Delays are not acceptable. Effective justice is not being delivered, and the accessibility of the court is being prejudiced because the delays are too long. It's not going to help to give sitting judges the opportunity of doing all sorts of outside work. And then the second aspect, the second thought is the retired judges, but I refer to the retired judges who can speak for themselves a lot better than I can. I can just mention one typo that I picked up along the way through, because I don't want it to be said that I can't read. And that typo is not. Now, I picked it up when I was doing my homework, and the typo is to do with the designation. It's on page 6 of the bill, section 8, subsection 4. If one looks at that, it's quite clear that the B, the subsection 1B, should actually be subsection 1C, because the designation is not referred to in B, it's referred to in C. So just to be helpful, please let all know that B in subsection 4 of section 8 on page 6 should read C.
Thank you very much, just want to say something in terms of your general comments on the issue of digitization of the country, I think really the 1989 legislation was really designed around the effects of digitization. Of course, you would bear in mind that the challenges that we face currently around the judiciary in terms of the transformation, particularly on the racial level, would mean that you would want to free up a lot of the acting positions for people who are potential judges. Given the fact that in any case, you did use somebody who was a judge charged from office, you would still need to compensate that individual. In other words, the judge question would be entitled to a double salary. Yes, that's exactly right. And so there are consequences, and there are realities given our transitional needs. But I'm quite sure that once we get to the point, and the Chief Justice was here not so long ago talking to us about the progress made in terms of the reflection of the diversity of our society and our education, that we, in the next few years, will get to the point where I imagine a lot of the acting positions will actually be by people who have been shot, as was originally intended by the 1989 legislation. But you'll hear some more, as you say, throughout the course of this discussion. Maybe just
before you move on to the next point, Madam Chair, can I just draw your attention to some research that has been done
at the University of Cape Town by Johan Trengro, who is a member of the House of Bar, on the use of acting judges in the system at the moment. I think it's going to be published later this year.
It'd be very useful information.
But I can make a copy.
The processing of this legislation is certainly welcome. I want to particularly deal with your suggestion around clause 4 of the legislation. You say there that the four members of the JSC designated vice president should not be eligible to be designated as acting chairperson of the JSC. What I want to ask you is, should we establish the principle that only judges chair meetings of the JSC? In other words, that your law professors and so on also should not be equally eligible to chair those meetings.
I would agree with that suggestion. The principle behind it relates to the independence of the judiciary. That's why we're saying that lay members of the Judicial Service Commission should not be in charge of what in essence is machinery around the administration.
Employment. It's a symbolic matter as well. JSC is a body that is designed to regulate matters pertaining to the judiciary, to advise the executive on very important matters pertaining to the judiciary. And as such, shouldn't necessarily be led in any symbolic sense by anybody other than that. Okay.
Yes, we agree.
So it's not just those members, but all of the other members. The other one that I wanted to raise with you is the more difficult one. Let's put it to you this way. Chapter 2, you make the same point about persons who are designated as this. Now, there I would tend to hesitate a little. I mean, what you don't want to necessarily entrench completely is a system of complete insulation when it comes, and it's almost an internal professional regulation of conduct. I mean, the judiciary is a vital component of your state. The good standing, the dignity, the integrity of the judiciary is an absolutely invaluable component for any democracy worth its salt. You point to Section 1 and you particularly point to the issue of transparency, accountability, all of those issues. One would imagine that those persons designated by the president, remember, they are not just party political people. Those are people who the president is nominating to get agreement from all political parties. Imagine that somebody like Mr. De Klerk might be an eminent South African who may enjoy the support of all parties and who would be eligible for that position. Somebody like now those people clearly the confidence of the South African citizens in people such as those members of our community, of our society, of that caliber, surely they can't be in objection to them being part of the whole design chapter 2.
The difficulty with that is that chapter 2 is there for oversight of judicial conduct. And its submission means that people who are doing that oversight know how to conduct a fair hearing. Remember that within the ANC, Professor Carter Hartnell chaired a meeting recently at the Chief Whip Friday night activities. And his approach to the matter has been reviewed and had to start again. So although he is a person in the same sort of category,
does it also get reviewed in that way with regard to appeal? What does that say? And the point that I'm making is simply, I don't mind the saying that, you know, they shouldn't share these people are not in the class, that they shouldn't share the children, that's the way they're not. But that they should be part and part, that they carry the confidence of the nation into those processes, but those processes, nothing they seem to be closed processes, therefore they should be done in themselves. Because then it lacks the credibility and it lacks particularly the value of the class of the community. And so for me, that would be a balanced way of introducing a degree of transparency into the system without necessarily overtly tampering with the integrity of the judicial system, the integrity of the judiciary as a whole, and so on.
Yes, well, my position on that is that conducting disciplinary proceedings is a specialized activity, and having superstars or well-accepted people sitting in that type of situation can lead to problems if they don't know procedures and the application.
I don't know that Mr.
DeClass
would be very happy about
it. Mr. DeClass is always, perhaps he's a bad example, but
So is Professor
Tarnow. Well, let's take two bad examples. It's a good reason not to do it.
Thank you.
Now,
one last issue is the limitations of school. Now, you seem to indicate that, and I'm not quite sure that I understand this, but let me argue this. A difference should be made between judges being either charged who have attained the age of 25. And he seems to suggest that in and of itself would make the constitutional tip problematic in regard to the year. Now, what I want to ask is your theory of the 89 legislation. Is it ever envisaged that there would be a separate dispensation for judges who have attained 75 insofar as it pertains to the requirement that they can also serve on the bench should they wish to. The point that I'm making is that the dispensation was before you reach the age of 75 is compelled. After it was related, you didn't want to even have to.
And so
how would you suggest that they are not equally judges as sitting
judges? The obligation of a judge who is under 75 is to give 3 months a year of what you could call active service is a confusing term because active service means judges or full time. So the judges between 70 and 75 have an obligation to give up 3 months a year on acting appointments approved upon the judge. Judges over 75 don't have that obligation, but they are indistinguishable for the 9 months of the year that you are not doing your campus, and to sort of tack on now a change in the dispensation. When the judges went into the dispensation on the basis that they would be free agents permanently from 75 and for 9 months a year between 70 and 75, it's to really unilaterally change their position.
What are we changing? I mean, I thought that the whole point of this legislation was essentially to keep that.
What is changing now is that the retired judges' entitlement to sit in court in neighboring states, be commissioners and commissioners inquiries, be
arbitrated. In fact, to practice their occupation, faith is being curtailed. That's the difficulty.
And entitlement. Where did it come? Not at all. The current situation is that if you're a serving judge or a judge that's charged for service, you apply for permission to do extrajudicial work. That's the current situation. That's not true. And the discretion is entirely the minister. What we're doing here is we're changing the discretion, opening it up a bit, to say that the minister must consult with the chief judge. There must be some objective criteria. So in a sense, we're making it more transparent. The current situation is entirely the discretion of the minister.
The minister's discretion cannot be arbitrary or capriciously exercised.
No, nobody
says
that it
is. I'm sorry, I need you in the third term and that course, you can't go and whatever.
That's fine. The point is that there's no entitlement, number one. Number two, that we're not changing anyone's intention at all. We are using what has always been 1989, that system, and carrying it forward. What we're trying to do is we're trying to open up some of those processes, as I said, instead of having the minister deciding by herself, using her discretion, to talk about their business and what is going on. Those would be challengeable, and that is me. But there's no change in the system. But I do thank you very much. As I said to you, we're very happy to receive submissions where we can see that people have thought through issues and so on. And it's always very useful. So what we do, just for your information, please, as you don't know how we operate. When you take your written submission and the legal draft is on that side, we'll summarize each point against each clause of the legislation for us, and we'll go through a process in the committee of formally looking at each of those clauses and your comments against each of those clauses, the application as well, and I see that we'll also make some suggestions in regards to that. So we do thank you very much for the effort. And wish you well. You can, of course, feel free to stay for the rest of the session and travel back safely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead if you want to ask.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Limited to writing the textbook and lecturing on topics of law. The difficulty that I have with the notion of full-time judges being allowed in this system to do outside work is that that has the potential to dilute the independence and impartiality of the judiciary. I don't know if anybody there for business day yesterday. The deputy judge president of the Transvaal, Phineas Mojapela, is a gentleman and a scholar, and he must be because he came to the launch of the Central Constitution has allowed himself to become involved on an unpaid basis as a trustee of a trust set up by First National. Called the Wake Up Trust from Malanga, and that trust actually was doing very good charitable work, and nobody could ever say, point a finger at the information. Now it's decided it's not getting enough money from its donors, and it is going into doing BEE deals in order to make money for the trust so that it can continue its work. And Judge Mojapela is now in a situation, having volunteered with his own time and his own effort to be a trustee of a trust, where all sorts of deals are being done, and where he is unable to sit in any matter in which at first Rand Bank's interest crops up, whether directly or indirectly. He can't say, sitting in part into these deals that the trust is doing, that he is in a position to sit in a case like that. Now, the draft legislation has got no time limit, no capping, no boundaries, but to what a judge can do. While I was having tea with my colleague from Rhodes University, he pointed out that a judge who is good at lecturing could get himself appointed on some international lecturing circuit in terms of this arrangement. And he could disappear and never be seen again, which might be very nice for South Africa's international image, but it won't help. People get access to justice because he won't be able to do the job that he's in place to do. To answer your question straight, I don't think that sitting judges should have our power.
Thank you. The reason I can raise those issues with you for, as I said, we will discuss them in some detail and in depth when we deal with the court by court session. Thank you very much. Very briefly, Dr. Bell.
The line we take there is that if the outside work that they're doing does not in any way impinge upon their ability to independently and impartially, without fear or favour, do their 3 months, that's fine. It's not going to hurt if they're a judge in a neighbouring country. It is going to hurt if they open a brothel or a mass office. Don't know that any
case.
Okay.
Thank you. We now come to the next submission, which is the memo that we got from Justice Crickler. Somebody tell me what the index is on it. Yes. So it's 5. Okay, it doesn't matter if it's 5 or 6, you can clearly see that the portfolio committee has had an apartheid education, we can't count. There are various documents. So, but if the memo specifically, which I think everybody has read before, I call upon. I'm not sure who's going to do the presentation with let me just put on record that you were not summoned here by us. You have come at your instance and assistance. So that we all are quite clear about that. I've also expressed at some stage to the Chief Justice my reluctance to the decision of the Constitutional Court to the effect that public hearing or this kind of session in Parliament is actually part and parcel of the legislative making process. And I've expressed some reservations, I must say they were my own, they know we have done some reservations about judges participating during the session, given that you are who you are. But I guess you're going to argue that you're not really just. Okay. And that's it. And that's it. Please proceed.
Which is this way, it really lies at the heart of our submission. We can't foresee any problems arising from hearings before this committee by people who are in effect retired judges and have no connection whatsoever and will not have at any stage. Because of our age with the judicial system at that. So I don't think there can be any questions raised about our appearance before you. Although I do agree with you there may be some problem with serving judges appearing here. That's not ours. Because we are, and that I say is part of our legislation, we are no more judges. We say that because we all know. Well, some of us to a lesser extent perhaps, but at least we know the history of this expression, discharge from active service. We know that it did not occur before 1989 in the legislation, or anywhere that we're aware of. Up to that stage, the judges were appointed, served until the maximum retirement age of 70, then retired, which was the word used in the legislation, and then went on pension, which was the word used in the legislation. That dispensation changed in 1989, and it was taken over by the 2001 Act, the system of so-called sending judges, or discharging judges from active service. But it means anything spark. Anything else than retirement. Because in terms of the very Constitution, section 176, a judge, whether it be a constitutional court judge, having that particular term, he serves that particular term, but all judges hold office, that is the word of the until the start from from this he said, the moment they discharge from active service, they no longer hold office as a judge. That is why we say, in effect, we are no longer judges. I know we fall, but I think that's the whole time sake. more than anything else, because in effect, that is what it is. Practically speaking, we know that on the day when you're discharged from active service, you leave your office, you leave your staff because you're not entitled to them any longer. You say goodbye to the registrar, who then ask you where your car key, because you say goodbye to your car unless you've arranged to buy it. You're not entitled to that any longer. And the main point is, you relinquish all judicial power and duties. You have no power whatsoever as a judge because you don't hold office any longer. And you don't have any judicial duties. Moreover, you don't have any judicial duties. Now we know that we do have judges who have duties. And that we protect the moment you go, you are discharged from that. That's why we say, although this catchword, call it whatever you like, discharge from active service was invented. It was invented, deliberately invented during 1989. Those of us who were part of the first know that. In order to overcome the problem of hitching pensions to existing salaries and increases in salaries. Because during 1999, when the minister wanted longer service from the retired judges, as they in terms of legislation, the judges wanted better conditions of employment. In Australia, they wanted better pensions for them and their widows. Eventually, this phrase was invented, this concept was invented. All right? There was some technical difficulty. My memory serves me right. It came from the Treasury at that stage. We can't hitch a pension to increases in sitting judge salary. So therefore, we are not going to call this pension anymore. Now, from now on, you'll get salary. But our submission is, of course, we know as lawyers, we're not fooled by words. We look at the substance of the matter, and we try to find out what is the reality of the situation. And our submission is that the situation in reality is that a judge sent, and whether he's below or above the age of 75, it doesn't matter. The only difference is that he has that obligation until he's 75 in the same extent. In principle, it makes no difference, because even the judge below 75 holds no office. Personally, I think, I know it's not being done. Personally, I think when such a judge is asked to sit on a matter, he has to retake the oath because he no longer has an office. Well, I had limited experience with that, but to the extent that I was in such a position. Anyway, our point is therefore, let's face the reality of the matter. In the Act it says, judges sent the South in active service get a salary. What in effect they get is exactly the same before 1989. They go home, they occupy themselves with whatever they please, and they can see what is called a salary. Now, why is this important to know? Because if you say this, you know, this word salary, if one just looks at the concept of that double salary in one of the things, when a judge does serve it, he gets a double salary. Now, can one ever suspect that the real intention was to give him a double salary for that month? The intention, obviously, is your pension will continue. But because you are working, you are now taking your salary. Moreover, if you look at section 11, that's the use of the word salary. You look at section 11, you'll find it deals with judges who resign. And a judge who resigns, they take his office, which is more or less the same thing as he's in the home. They take his office. Yet he receives what is also there called a salary. No one can imagine what he is really getting is a salary. He's severed always ties with the department, always ties with the state, always claimed to be in jail. Now, normally, I mention this to support now, what we are getting, and we certainly will, sometimes we even get a position in the department, talking about things, and that is okay. As this only becomes important to you, because we say, incidentally, my personal situation is just made, and I don't know what said that in about 622. But we say that this legislation is indeed unconstitutional, because to the extent that a retired judge's record is not permitted to occupy and, well, to perform and conduct a profession or occupation without consent, without the ministerial consent. That is infringement of Section 22. And the question really is, can there be justification in terms of citizens? And we say where the state has no longer any interest in you as a judge, because you have no duty, you don't serve the judge. What earth to be interested in the state having? What earth interest can public interest have? We say that there is no justification, bearing in mind the reality of the but apart from constitutionality, we also submit that this section is so sick and so mad. This situation may be received at the region in section whatever it is of the 2001 Act requiring the that did not exist before 2001. We will find the provision in the Supreme Court of Act of 1959, something similar. That no judge may occupy junior housing. But that act obviously didn't apply to retired judges. It applied to serving judges. And why I say that, if you look at the terms of the act, there is not a single section that can be applied to a retired judge. And significantly, there is one instance where the act, the Supreme Court, does speak of a former act. Former judge, one of the sections dealing with the appointment of the Chief Justice, where it says the Chief Justice may only be appointed from the law. He can only be a judge or a former judge, the express word of the section, may be appointed the Chief Justice. But apart from that, no provision of the 59 Act can apply to a retired judge. Remember, this was passed in a time when judges, in terms of the legislation, retired. And nothing in what is, no provision, they are all practical provisions, as we all know, can be applied to retired. Now, in the 89 Act, when this new system of discharging judges from service was devised, this prohibition of work came for the first time in 2001. It was then only a brief split, for we strongly suspect that it came in by way of oversight. It was certainly oversight on the judge. Remember, the prohibition against workers of the Senate can only be extended in terms of the 2001 Act by using the definition of judge, which is said to include any person who held the office of judge at 1st April 1989. And it's in that process that retired judges also became. They can frankly say that from the other side, we didn't even realize that when we were in the journey. I don't think on the partner's part we realized it. But subsequently, did realize it. We did work on the basis of having point is, this is an existing regime, yes. Agreed by principle. The existing regime is unconstitutional, unreasonable, for reasons which I'll discuss now. And therefore, it shouldn't be
anything. You're winding down now.
Right. Let me just say that I know of no other profession, no other recognized occupation, which requires a view of the minister to consent. I know of no other occupation where I may run a business today and may make tons of money by farming. I don't need the minister's consent. But the moment I want to apply the skills that I've acquired over the years by work that I know to do, then I yes, which is exactly the same thing. You still don't have any duties. You're also relieved of your duties. I have no
duties. There is a problem for the judge opting to go with the second amendment rule. There's a consequence, a negative consequence.
Negative consequence of the charge of duties. I think it wasn't intended as a quid pro quo. We all know that the 5% of what every year might get away with is far outweighed by the strict minimum.
Well, just on this point, just because you see, 89 is a long time ago, and certainly any of us have not there in time to do really well. And one of the things that we'd like to do is just draw some of your experience on the 89 and 89. I've got a little table there that you'll have to excuse because I'm not a very good scientist, and that's the note that I've made. What is effectively trying to do is try to understand what the 89 regime was all about. Now, in the first column, you have judge on matters that everybody understands. Then you move to a judge in charge of active service. Now explain that to me. What happens? You spend your 15 years, you then get to a point. Explain practically what happens in your case.
Well, if you say, I remember probably doing some talking to you.
I'm talking about the regime. The regime changes.
You mean pre-89 and post-89?
Yeah, currently. You are under the schema here.
Yes.
Now, you are now a judge that's charged from
active. Yes.
You are meant to be available for service at
yes.
the time.
Yes.
Because this is your brand.
Yes.
You probably could see a scene
yes.
that you call ingenious in your
exactly.
Now, this ingenious system is what I'm trying to understand. You're saying to me that there's in effect no difference between a Section 11 and a judge who's done from that system. Now, what I want to do is explain and unpack that for me in terms of these criteria here.
I'm sorry. I didn't express myself properly. There's no difference money-wise, salary-wise. Except for the increase.
That's money-wise. So, I'm trying to understand. See, when we draft laws, you have to have a plan.
Yes.
Now, the plan is what I'm trying to understand. Because clearly, and from what I gather from those in the Justice Department who have been around for a long time, there was an active engagement. In other words, a gentleman's agreement that was forced.
comes from after the Christmas. It didn't appear, and I looked again last night, I checked, it's not from the 1890s.
Then says to you, okay, you'll get whatever you've always gotten. But in addition to sweeten it for you, you then get a tax-free gratuity upon your retirement. And you then get, if you were to perform work, the 3 months in question, and of course, any other period that you would voluntarily commit to, you would then get an additional salary over and above your salary plus. And the question that I ask is, what in it for the system? But they're paying for it. So basically, the only thing they got out of the deal was that you wouldn't take long leave.
No. I was there. I walked the corridor between the chambers to get senior counsel to the test appointment, which still you could see a mandate. But the paper comes from the bench. Never mind that he really came to the paper, but he will get a decent pension. You will be looked after, and your leader will be looked after, you get his experience. That's what the executive is about. They've got judges, which they would not have got out of. I know I was there. I was a candidate. I went to people like Mandela, but I was a woman. But each one of them was a particular form of condition. They were black after 5 years, but I was a black person.
There are other ways to secure
a
new recruit rather than benefiting those who are currently on.
No doubt, but that was the deal today.
I'm sorry.
I have no financial interest in this. I've done my duty. I've done 2 years through my after retirement. I have a minister's office to do what I like. I'm here because I think you're making a great deal. I have no interest in this. None of my two colleagues are over there. We talk to you about it.
No, you may not at this stage, so I want to finish the point. Because you see, I don't know that, and one thing I'm getting, because my wife said, it's useful to hear from you. But what I did manage to find, what the researchers managed to find for me, is a little snippet from Hansa. Where the Minister of Justice was in 1989 explaining what he thought of the, or what he thought the aim of the Commission was. And this is what I want to put to you. He says, firstly, and I'm quoting, firstly, to make appointments to the bench more attractive, not only to convince and help counsel to get appointments, but also to encourage them to join the bench. Secondly, to accommodate as far as possible the increase in the volume of work on the bench within the existing dispensation rather than enlarging it. For me, it seems to deal with the conservation issue. I want to deal with the case backdrop within the existing dispensation of the division. And by so doing, allowing counselors to cover some of the ineffective body of justice, they have basically just wanted to expand. Obviously for financial reasons. Then it says, thirdly, to entrench the independent status of a judge for the duration of the life. Well, you see, this is very interesting to me because this is really central to the concept of judges for life. Now, he goes on and he says, the package as a whole embodies a few basic points of the past. Firstly, we are now locally confirming the principle that once a person has been appointed as a judge, he always remains a judge. This is said in Parliament. This is not an unfamiliar concept in the Western world, having been implemented for a long time in our countries such as the United States of America. Instead of retiring, as is the case at present, on reaching a specific age or after completing a certain number of years, a judge is merely removed from active service. So it's a very conscious decision, not semantic, as we call it in the English. Very conscious decision to call it a salary, because it's not a semantic concept. Salary versus a pension. You work for a salary. He does, however, continue to occupy the post and to receive the salary attaching to the relevant post, but on the other hand, he is subsequently compelled until the age of 75 to be available for service for 3 months per year. Continues. He says, owing to the continual increase in the workload today, it is more often the rule than the exception to request that judges reach retirement age to continue to serve in an active capacity. Although a judge can be excluded under the new dispensation to perform at least 3 months' service per annum after his removal from active service, there is, of course, nothing to prevent him from serving on a full-time basis if that should exist. Even if he were to serve the minimum period, or even perform no further service, he still continues to occupy the post. So, you see my difficulty here. The difficulty is that we have, on the one hand, entrenched in law the concept of the judge for life. No differentiation usually made between those who are self-serving and those who are not. There's no real difference in dispensation. Ultimately, I imagine that if you reach the age of 75, and if you were healthy enough, fit enough, interested enough, you could continue on a voluntary basis. That was the system. This is how it was designed. And the reason why you didn't have to live in this context, you wouldn't go to the JP and say, here I am, and you can do it, is because you're a judge for life. That's the understanding that the concept is that. Certainly that seems to be the difference. I'm saying to you what it is that we work. The other question that I want to ask is that, as I said earlier, this seems to be what is currently in place. Now, I must say that in your submission you talk about the mechanism being a prohibitive.
Control.
I regard it as a protective measure. In other words, the issue at the very heart of the entire debate is first and foremost the maintenance of the integrity of the standing of the position. And in this, it can't be that the only interest is that of the position. It must be that in any democracy, we pass laws, let me give you an example, we pass laws. We sit here for hours and hours and debate and we fight with each other and vote and make sure that the laws are set. You have a judiciary who suddenly falls into disrepute because one or other. But you have a severely damaged judicial reputation in a country that otherwise functions well. The legislature, the law, becomes frankly not worth the paper of this country because the citizenry are facing this situation. Now, standing internationally, highly taken in the world. Our economy can very seriously be affected. to suggest that the legislature doesn't have an interest in the reputation of the judiciary, to my mind, is very limited to it. To suggest that the executive doesn't have an interest in protecting the integrity of the standing and reputation of our judiciary is also very limited.
Of course, I can see that they have every interest in the judiciary. For that reason, we say we are no longer part of
the Let me ask you one question, one very specific question. Would you agree that even though you're retiring from the profession, you're still in relation to the judiciary in a very privileged position, given that you may have mentors for people who are currently actively on the bench, given that obviously you get a collegial relationship with people on the bench, given that you have access that ordinary social space is not ordinary, that they may hold you and your views in high esteem? And for that reason, you clearly cannot see how the ordinary social space works as part of the ordinary.
But I have very same respect for my first-time law professor, who is not a judge. Not because he was a judge, but because of the adherence I have for him. But now I'm going to say this again. We cannot simply, we have no problem with the state interest in the judiciary. But we do say, if you do not hold office as a judge, how can you say to be in the judiciary? If I go today, if I'm found in the block, the block will be on me. You can't say it's the judiciary. They may say, yes,
Members, I've got Dr. Delford, Ms. Johnson, anybody else? Imam? Okay. I know you.
But put no information in the main minister. He came up with a very interesting speech which as a way of getting benefits in place. To accommodate the judges on the one hand, but then to give something back to the minister. That is why there was the judge, a serving judge, in the environment.
Get the questions. Maybe you can take note of it, Janice, and then you'll respond as a whole. I've got, I think, Imam is next. Or is it Johnson? I can't say.
I think it's
Johnson. Ms. Johnson, please go ahead. Judge, just on the topic, slightly a little bit wider than the position of the board and your comments. On the whole sort of relationship between the judiciary and the legislature. Some of the criticisms that we, as members of this committee, have been hearing from our colleagues here in the parliamentary classes lately, and I thought it would be fair to put it to you to get a response from you, is that we often sit and deal with bills, for example, recently dealt with sexual offences bills, where our retired judges have a wealth of experience that work in sexual offences courts, but never do say breakfast with their presence or give us their input. The only time the Justice Committee hears anything from retired judges or judges is when it is a matter that directly affects their past. And I would like to hear your response to that.
Thank you very much.
I have 2 points to make here. Number one, one of the issues that I was in 1989 when Mr. Quillick was seen made some of these sort of nonsense. May I have the answer to this one? When you were available for 3 months service at the time, were you then paid for that service? That's the second question.
No.
Second, if, for example, the judges who are now, you know, out of active service, for example, want a blanket and open space to do as they deem the territory or do what was it, right? The conflict of interest as far as judges are concerned, right, is a very, very serious as you have, right? Don't you think, honorable retired judges, that to give a blanket and open regime here will increase the potential for conflict of interest if they should come back to the bench to hear one more time?
I also want to just talk a little bit about the argument relating to the limitation.
Judges for life in the main thing.
And to get a fellow.
You know, I'm talking about the fate and the state of a judge for life. That cannot be, you know, what evidence is there coming to be accepted. I know that it gets up by far. We receive benefits from life, let's put it that way. That's the only thing. Tell me that I'm a judge with no judicial duties, no judicial power, that judge. You're not a judge. Secondly, I'm talking about judges involvement in sexual matters. But I don't know what happens in the other provinces, but let me just say that I know what's happening in Luther. And I know that there is involvement in sexual matters is something fairly big. We need to start that.
I think in the context of what Ms. Johnson is saying, that you have asked to come here, I would say to me, in the next few months, before to suggesting that it has a direct impact on the property.
Of course we do.
However, when it comes to matters such as a very difficult piece of legislation, legally and otherwise, where we open up for discussion and we invite people to be discussed. Retired judges, particular position that we feel that we can actually start to say in your own discussion.
My response is question, then, you must realize that when you sit at home and you look at the internet now and then, or even newspaper now and then, you don't get invitations to go and attend these functions. You are more often than not even aware of the importance of until you see the discussion in the paper. I think there are certainly judges who will certainly be prepared to offer whatever they know, their knowledge of what happened. If the opportunity were presented, then lastly there is the observation that there may be conflict of interest during that part of that 5-year period, as I understand. Remember that limitation, they call it a limitation instead of a ban on doing other remunerative work, was not imposed in 1989. It didn't exist at that time. Not on the fire judges, madam. Go and read the 59.
The regime is people apply. Even at that time. But they are others can. People let out those things by hand. Why? Your judges. You can't possibly compare yourself to any other judges. There is a special dispensation in your conscience.
You are confused myself to what? Judges. And if I am not a judge, I will know that I can't walk into the high court here and say, I must promise you the same truth. I can't walk into the green state and say, open the door and I want to be a prisoner. I've got no proof.
Yes, as you were asking the question, you interrupted and said yes.
Thank you.
the chair. Chair, we are busy here with the legislative function as we sit now, too. That's part of our duties as this committee. I want just to establish matters with the judges. My understanding is that they argue now on this principle and that it will affect judges that are presently also acting. Well, judges that eventually will retire or be discharged.
Active.
If you are correct, if you are able to convince us then to change the proposal rule as it is, that it will affect other judges. So equally now we could in fact have judges sitting before us now that are actually still acting. If you understand. Your case is that you are no longer the judge, but equally what you are arguing for here is something that will affect people that are presently still judges. But I just want to understand within
the answer there is no. What we are proposing does not affect active judges in active service.
No, it will affect them when they retire.
When they retire,
yes. And so you actually, one should actually see you then as spokesperson for those people too.
Yes.
Because you cannot argue here that you're just arguing for a closed club. And that this argument is not to hold for people that will eventually land up in the fishing machine. But the question then is, I'm just wondering now, how we are to deal with that, given the separation of powers. You know, you have the judiciary, you have the question now of the legislature, you are actively engaging us in legislation that is going to affect, so to say, the trade. And we'd just like to hear you on how you would see us look at this, given the separation of powers.
In your deliberations, whether it should go through, you obviously make progress to take account of what you said, and that is what the separation of powers is.
No, I think the point that I think, look, I want to just point out a little bit on the limitations. We're running out of time, but I'm giving an opportunity. Very, very briefly.
I think the legislation and the legislation of the
if it's
real,
if it's But if the criminal justice system is found in judicial review,
I would be liable to prosecute.
So let's not be semantic about it. I think the point is very clear that what they're trying to do, and if you don't want it to mistake, we don't want the minister to publish strategy and then we'll take it off to you.
No.
Because I thought that it would be a benefit to people who are applying so that they understand up front what would by and large constitute an application that would be successful.
I think I've taken the wrong way. I made the point. You can ignore it if you like. I'm on record as telling you that there is a problem with a contract between 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. You could use it if you like. I've done my
job. Thank you very much. But I think that when you make those points, you also have to answer questions that you pose.
Ask me the question I want to answer.
Do you want the criteria or not?
I want criteria in full, certainly. But I don't want ad hoc application. Why shouldn't it be?
So you want a list of services that you can bring them? And you want that published up front.
Yes.
And if that list, because you see the difference that I thought was quite obvious, is that the list in the first part would be a very narrow list, an extremely narrow list. And in fact, we're now considering not having a list. Would the same apply to the second part?
It's the ad hoc application that makes it.
So you would want a comprehensive list of every possible professional
if you've got to do the legislation, at least we will have to obtain equitable basis as does it on taxation.
Your concern would then be that it's not comprehensive.
No. No, I said discriminate against the people who are not on that.
You'll consider that. I mean, if that's what you're now saying on record that you want to do this, and it's a closed list, I'll be very happy with that. We really have to close this session. I'm going to allow Dr. Dalport a last question, and then I want to... I'm going to allow a last question, and then I want closing remarks. And then we quickly admit our 10:30 tea for sleeping. Now 10:30 water, cold, terrible. And so please, Dr. Dalport, please.
For the entire group, whatever
give us a list, not that limited one of trying to judge for obvious reasons, but tell us beforehand, you may do X, Y, and Z. That's all that my colleagues have said. But I think that points out to what you may have said. First of all,
I want to suggest
acting in consultation with the Minister of Justice, must compile a code of judicial conduct. Now, it is suggested that in light of the separation of powers, this should be entirely the task of the judiciary. The task of the Minister should only be to act as a conduit so that it can be introduced in Parliament and published in the government meeting. But it is the task of the judiciary to draft such a book, and a draft of such a code of conduct can be published upon not to take in 2003 so that can be a law. Judiciary draft law.
Whereas I deem it important that there be a thorough investigation to the judge,
Although your ideal model would be to have the tribunal drawn from the members of the bill. Isn't there a practical problem?
It would be because, as it currently stands, the judges serving in there are senior judges who have big responsibility. You can't sit and lay the tribunal, that may take forever. So the idea was really to have a pool of people available to do such service, drawn from the ranks of judges, and utilizing them, and they may not necessarily be part of the JSC membership, so they represent the by their But I see what you're saying, but what I can't see is, and your alternative does help in the sense that it's in fact responsible to draw from that membership, I guess, to what politicians do to the club. You know, they should really not. So, I wouldn't be a fan of you may not. and so you see the difficulty. The difficulty is, and it may be that you have to say that the JSC must prioritize as a result. I mean, ultimately, it's going to take a lot. I always say, this thing is such a culturing mechanism for somebody to be impeached is going to take a lot. And so the situation itself is particularly dire. And if it even gets to the tribunal, I'll be able to describe it. The most days will be smaller and will be dealt with by other people and so on. But really a very, very seriously harmful matter that harmful is just for the recognition that we actually go to the tribunal. So for the tribunal to then recommend to have a full-up plan, to also ensure that our members
one issue that we had noted in the committee that does not appear in the board anymore. Our board has. The issue of a committee, remember this JCC was meant to also guide on ethics, so that when somebody has a problem, they could go and speak with them. That's not the reason to speak with them before. And I can't imagine that that would be a useful tool for the judiciary before, because, I mean, we live in a new age, and there are situations have you considered perhaps this issue, because I do know that you were saying judicial regulation. But this was one of the ways in which we were proposing the judges regulate their actually develop for the paper.
The only reason why judges would want that, if this code, as you do, that it has to have some sort of reason to say, perhaps they wouldn't want the ethics to be part of that.
It's meant to be a separate.
It's passive. So the idea is that it has to be separate. But I do think there must be some sort of a legislative provision to allow for that, because in the absence of a legislative provision to allow for it, I mean, a code like that can be drafted and put in a drawer and everyone can forget about that. And public members of the public will not have recourse to such a code if it is just a code.
But the idea is really to help the judiciary.
Absolutely. But to help the judiciary and also to
not
realize
not go the next route of, you know, getting to the gate, getting people to walk away. And so it's more of a tool to guide them to the terrain.
And to enhance dignity and the
absolute
position. But I do think that it's something that's completely within the terrain of the opposition. They should themselves run with it.
Well, the JCC basically supports our own agency.
No, it is. So what is the status? I think
it's about the future. The question is not to say, of course, that heads of courts don't play that role in any case.
But it's not formal enough.
Exactly. So that if even a head of court is stopped by something, if they could be a formal discussion at some point or a head of court, I'm sure it's very useful.
No, I agree with you. But I don't know whether this will take. Perhaps not. Perhaps this will not. Alternatively, if the Judicial Service Commission in some way deals with ethics in any case, a subcommittee of that, you know, perhaps, I don't know, perhaps just in a more informal manner than straightforward.
But the objection then is that the JSC doesn't, the membership of the JSC is not absolutely judging from that. Okay, no, look, we'll, that's certainly one aspect that I would want to reintroduce in some sense. Because I do think that it's an important aspect. But look, that's neither here nor there at this stage. We do have to round up, and I see people have left already. Can I just check whether members have any comments, any statements? Okay, then all that's left for me to do is to thank all of you. Let me just also remind all of you that we go over your submission, your written submission, again, very carefully, as every teaching is called. So, and if you want to follow our discussions, you're very welcome to come and attend the conversation. And I know that the PMG has got a webcast. called a parliamentary monitoring group. You must get to this table for time for you and send you a
I'll give them a call.
Thank you very much. Members, we will see each other then on Tuesday. Please remember the searching commitment. We have distributed all of the submissions that we've got. Oh, I must just say that we did get a submission from that file, which I mentioned to the London today. And I have it in my packet. Members, I don't know if you do, but I'm sure I would have distributed it. The problem is that we lost it sometimes February, and it was on a different version of the book. But there are still some salient points that you made and some issues that you raised that are still in the 40-hour discussion. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to find it and redistribute it. Show me if I've lost it because we're not able to control at that time. So that must please look out for that and put it in this particular set of documents of yours. Also, remember Tuesday 13th Amendment. We've got about four or five different submissions there, which we will be going through on Tuesday as well. So we'll take a briefing in the morning. We'll finish the briefing and we go straight into the submissions that we've received. So bring all of those documents along, not just the relationship. As can Jonathan. Mr. BC will send you SMSs as to the new venue, but it is at 10 o'clock on Tuesday that we start. Please make a note of that, okay? And lunch is being served outside in 5 minutes. Thank you very much.
You get on the 2 o'clock flight.
Keeping where you are, I'm just thinking where to where you should live. you to spend time reading it as well. And then I hope
I'm going to have to take you there.
Thank you.